Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I've never been horsewhipped in public by a former lover, but I'd imagine it's a humiliating and painful experience. One man who could verify this assumption was General Ben Vaillun, a hero of the Boer War, who was publicly horsewhipped by his fiancée in Chicago in January 1905. The woman who administered the horsewhipping was the colourful May Belfour, a vaudeville dancer and singer, famous in the music halls of London and Paris. Her fury was aroused by that sin that is as old as time itself, a broken promise. Although the name May Belfour may not mean anything to you, there's a good chance that you've seen her. She features in a number of well-known posters and paintings by Toulouse-Lautrec. Perhaps the best known is one which depicts her on stage wearing a vivid red dress and equally vivid red lipstick. In reviews, she's usually described as English or Anglo-French, but in fact, May Belfour was Irish and had started life in County Mayo as May Egan in 1873. She moved to England, where she developed a stage act that involved dressing as an overgrown girl and lisping the lyrics of suggestive songs while stroking a black cat that she held in the crook of her arm. As if to justify the presence of the cat, she frequently performed the song Daddy Wouldn't Buy Me a Bow Wow, which includes the line, I have a little cat, and I'm very fond of that. If you look carefully at the Toulouse-Lautrec poster, you'll see the cat partially concealed by the frills of her sleeves. In her early 20s, May Belfour was performing to acclaim in Paris. Newspapers praised her exceptional talent as a dancer, her elegant appearance, and her ability to sing admirably well in French. In Paris's Olympia Theatre, where she shared a billing with Ali Camusa, the lion tamer, she danced Irish jigs and was considered by all to be very charming. Toulouse-Lautrec certainly found her so, and regularly dined with her in her apartment not far from the Moulin Rouge. One account of their friendship claims that while the artist was painting May in his studio, he attempted to become physically intimate with her. She rejected his advances, citing the overpowering smell of garlic from his breath as the reason. This may well have contained some truth, but it could also have been because she already had a lover, an Englishwoman, May Milton, also a cabaret performer. Toulouse-Lautrec went on to create a poster of May Milton, which has acquired a sort of meta-existence, by virtue of being visible in Picasso's painting The Blue Room, where it hangs on the wall over the bed. May Belfour and General Vaillun met in London. They had what she described as a casual acquaintanceship. According to her version of events, a few years after first meeting, they both just happened to be on board the same ship, sailing to South Africa, where she was to perform. Their friendship deepened. It deepened even further on the return journey to England when, once again, they both just happened to be passengers on the same ship. By the time they disembarked in London, they were engaged. News that Belfour and the General were to marry came as a surprise to many, not least the General's wife. When reports of her husband's affair reached her in Johannesburg, she immediately sued for divorce. The General departed for the US shortly afterwards on business. His early letters were tender. May, my sweetheart, how I love you. The tears rush out of my eyes when I think of the happy days I spent in your dear home. Ever and always your own, Ben. Within a year, however, he sounds more like a bank manager rejecting a loan application. He writes bluntly, I cannot look to any prospect of making you a home. I can't afford it. My dear girl, the day of marriage with me is past forever. Yours very sincerely, B.J. Vaillun. But if the general thought he was going to wash his hands of May Belfour that easily, he was sorely mistaken. Belfour tracked him down to Chicago and confronted him one evening as he was entering the Coliseum concert hall. "You promised to marry me, and have not done so," she declared. "I have come from England purposely to punish you." With that, she produced the horsewhip, and in front of a large crowd of interested spectators, as the newspapers phrased it, she gave her former lover a sound and presumably satisfying thrashing. Alas, this story does not end happily. Within months, Vayun married a woman from Illinois and spent the remainder of his life involved in politics and agriculture. As for May, a California newspaper reported in 1929, "Miss May Belfour, known as the darling of the London Music Hall, has died in poverty in Santa Barbara after a lingering illness. She amassed a considerable fortune in her stage career, but lost it in ill-advised mining investments and had recently been eking out a living by weaving rugs." This is not how I want to remember May Belfour. When the legend becomes fact, print the legend, we're told. I prefer the legend of the Irish jigs in a Paris cabaret, the coy but knowing young Mayo woman captured by Toulouse-Lautrec. Most of all, I prefer the legend of the horsewhip.
I love my little cat, I do. Its coat is oh so warm. It comes each day with me to school and sits upon the form. The teacher says, "Why do you bring that little pet of yours?" I tell her that I bring my cat along with me because...
A hyena in a petticoat was how Horace Walpole described Mary Wollstonecraft. Others were nastier still, including Maria Edgeworth, who modelled the bizarre Harriet Freke in her novel Belinda on Wollstonecraft. Pilloried in the 18th century for daring to question the place of women in society, A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, published in 1792, is now regarded as the first manifesto of women's rights. What drove her to write A Vindication was disappointment. Disappointment that the new constitution in post-revolutionary France, the great hope of the Enlightenment, offered citizenship to men only and a mere domestic education to women. Women, it seemed, were too hysterical to learn maths or science. They were men's inferiors, incapable of rational thought, uneducable. "Nonsense," said Mary Wollstonecraft. Women's apparent triviality was a direct consequence of society's failure to educate them. To modern feminists, she is a brave pioneer who paid a high price for daring to say such things. The second of seven children, Mary Wollstonecraft, was born into genteel circumstances in London in 1759. Her mother, the unhappy Elizabeth Dixon, from Main Street, Ballyshannon, County Donegal, was frequently ill, while her drunken and irascible father, Edward Wollstonecraft, slowly squandered the family wealth. According to Mary's biographer, Claire Tomalin, Edward allowed Mary bear the brunt of the family's falling fortunes, forcing her into the role of surrogate mother to her siblings and protector of her mother. The schooling that she and her younger sisters received was minimal, while their older brother Ned attended grammar school and went into law. Ned would later inherit a portion of his grandfather's estate, while the three girls received nothing. In The Common Reader, Volume 2, Virginia Woolf writes, "The staple of Wollstonecraft's doctrine was that nothing mattered save independence." Woolf, burning with empathetic anger, contends that Mary had been in revolt all her life, against tyranny, against convention, and fumes that Edward's profligacy had forced his daughter into the detested role of so many women of her class, that of governess. In October 1786, 27-year-old Mary arrived at Mitchelstown Castle, County Cork, the seat of Lord and Lady Kingsborough, to take up her new position. Wild, Irish and unformed was Mary's curt assessment of her charges. Believing that education should be child-centred and allow children to develop at their own pace, Mary soon won over the three Mrs. King. Her brief tenure with them would change their fates forever, especially that of 14-year-old Margaret King. "She freed my mind of all superstition," was Margaret's great tribute to her teacher, that extraordinary woman to whom I trace the development of whatever virtues I possess. Later in life, Margaret King would flout convention and adopt Wollstonecraft's democratic and feminist ideals to live adulterously in Italy. Renouncing her title, Margaret assumed the name Mrs. Mason, Wollstonecraft's alter ego in her children's book, Original Stories from Real Life, based on her experiences as governess in Mitchelstown. Fired from her position, Mary returned to London and resolved to earn her living as a writer, a virtually unheard-of path for a woman at that time. "She was," she wrote to her sister, "trying to become the first of a new genus." At a gathering in honour of Thomas Paine, Mary met the free-thinking political philosopher William Godwin. With friendship melting into love, as Rosita Sweetman in her book Feminism Backwards tells it, and in keeping with their radical and rationalist principles, they maintained separate houses. But they did marry when Mary became pregnant. On August 30th, 1797, she gave birth to a daughter. But septicemia set in, and after 10 days of agony, Mary Wollstonecraft died. Her daughter, also named Mary, would grow up to marry the poet Percy Shelley and write one of the great novels of all time, Frankenstein. Devastated, the grief-stricken Godwin rushed his memoirs of his wife into print within a year. He felt it was a loving tribute to Mary's life and struggles, and in keeping with his liberal philosophy, was completely candid. He recounted not only her literary triumphs, but also her obsessions and romances, her out-of-wedlock affairs and pregnancies, her dark depressions and her suicide attempts. Readers were shocked and repulsed. Mary's work disappeared for more than 100 years and didn't re-emerge until feminism reasserted itself in the 20th century, starting with the suffragettes. In 1915, Virginia Woolf predicted that it would take another six generations for women to come into their own. "If Woolf's maths was as good as her English," writes Mary's biographer Lyndall Gordon, "we should be approaching that finish line around now."
On the night of the 8th of March, 1966, I was awoken by the loud explosion which signalled the downfall of Nelson's Pillar on O'Connell Street. Like all Northside boys in the 1960s, I was familiar with O'Connell Street, particularly Cofola's ice cream salon. The next day, it was the talk of St. Canice's National School, but I think it's fair to say that we snotty-nosed brats had little historical context. It's hard to remember any particular reaction from our environment, except my parents' amused contempt at the sheer stupidity of it, the reckless endangering of the lives of Dublin citizens. As it happens, I had never actually ascended the pillar, something I'd never thought about until a few years later when I started to read Ulysses and came across Stephen Dedalus's anecdote about the two sisters who ascend the pillar with a bag of plums, which they proceed to consume, dropping the stones on the heads of those below. I have to say, I then experienced a sharp pang of regret at having been deprived of a quintessential Dublin experience. Many years later again, I was having another quintessential Dublin experience, that is, drinking a pint in the hallowed precincts of Grogan's on South William Street, a pub presided over by the myriad-minded, now greatly missed, Tommy Smith. There I met an ancient man supping on his pint, who confidentially informed me that he was the one who had planted the bomb under Lord Nelson, or at least had been involved in some way. The details were hazy. A couple of years later, in exactly the same spot, a different pint supper told me exactly the same thing, though he also informed me that the demolition had been codenamed Operation Humpty Dumpty. Recently, while sojourning for a while in the beautiful city of Prague, I became interested in another monument which had been blown up. After the post-war communist takeover in Czechoslovakia, it was decided to build a statue of Joseph Stalin overlooking the city centre, and sculptors were invited to enter a design competition. It was, of course, a poisoned chalice, so there were few entries. A futurist sculptor, Ottokar Schwetz, entered, not expecting to win, but hoping to pick up a small fee. To his horror, his design won. A few days before its unveiling, on May Day 1955, he took his own life. The granite statue would be the biggest group statue in Europe and the biggest statue of Stalin in the world. It towered above the river and dominated the views from the bridges leading into the historic heart of the city, the Josefov Quarter and the Town Hall Square. It was a statue which made quite a statement, but soon the process of de-Stalinization would begin and a hated statue was blown up in October 1962 using 800 kilos of explosives. All that remained was the huge plinth on which it had stood. At various times, the plinth has housed a pirate radio station and a nightclub. By the time I got to Prague, it was being used by skateboarders and inside housed an unofficial museum. As in many post-communist countries, the presentation of recent history was a live issue. A coalition of concerned citizens, believing that if you have an official museum, you get the official story, had decided to make their own citizens' museum. One day, I decided to have a look and schlepped up the endless steps leading to the massive concrete pedestal. It was quite creepy inside the plinth, and you could walk around it in darkness on wooden walkways fenced in with chicken wire. Here, an audio-visual display recreated the sensations of being in Prague during a German bombing raid. As usual, however, I wandered off the beaten track and soon found myself in a dark corner filled with rubble. Using my mobile phone as a torch, I saw that the rubble consisted of large chunks of granite. I wondered how it had gotten there, and then the truth slowly dawned on me. When the monstrous monument had been destroyed, faced with the problem of what to do with the rubble, the iconoclasts had chosen the path of least resistance and dumped the fragments of the statue in the plinth on which it had once stood. It seemed strangely Humpty Dumpty-like. I emerged blinking into the light of day and, somewhat bemused, walked back down to the city. As I crossed the bridge into Staraye Miesto, or the old city, I looked up at the empty space where the statue had been and thought of how in some imagined future, when history has become a Disneyland theme park, they might be able to haul out the pieces of old Joe Stalin and, unlike Humpty Dumpty, put them back together again.
Up went Nelson in old Dublin. Up went Nelson in old Dublin. All along O'Connell Street the stones and rubble flew. Nelson and the Pillar too. One early morning in the year of 66, a band of Irish laddies were knocking up some tricks.
My grandmother always wore a hat. There were four or five models of different colours and styles hanging on the hooks of her hall stand. Some were everyday felt hats, others were for Sundays, and there was a finely plaited straw one for summer. I remember her squinting at the tiny mirror on the hall stand when she pulled on a hat, tweaked it into position, and then ran the tips of her fingers along the crown for the perfect position to stab it with a hat pin. Then she'd turn to me and say, "A girl's best friend is her hat pin." She had a hedgehog of hat pins stuck into a special holder. Some were simple beads on pins, but others were more ornate. There was a big pearl bubble that her best friend sent her from New York. Another was a knob of serpentine stone that was a gift from Cornwall. But the one I particularly liked was the tiny seashell with a pearl lodged in it. Alas, her hatpins disappeared when she left us. Gone like the bonnets of yesteryear, when hatpins came into being in the mid-19th century, and dispensed with the ribbons that had to be tied under the chin to hold them in place. Hat styles were linked to the changes in dress fashion. A long, slim skirt and a neat pleated blouse called for a hat of distinction, and they were outlandishly decorated. No exotic bird was safe in its native habitat. Osprey, ostrich, and the poor bird of paradise were hunted down almost to extinction for their tail feathers to adorn hats because fashion dictated it. In 1904, Edward VII granted a charter to the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds in order to put a stop to this, and Queen Alexandra made a public announcement that she would no longer wear osprey feathers on her hats. In America, an anti-plumage law was passed in 1913. England was a little slower off the mark, but the anti-plumage law was passed there in 1921. Back in 1910, newspaper headlines stated that the hatpin was society's newest and most dangerous lethal weapon. Notices were put up on London buses, trams and trains that the points of hatpins had to have a protective stopper. Suffragette prisoners were brought to court wearing their hats minus their hatpins in case they were tempted to use them as weapons. In fact, there was one particular hatpin design of a double ring into which, should a lady feel threatened, she could slide her index finger and use it as a dagger. No wonder my grandmother told me that a girl's best friend is her hatpin. The hatpin came to the fore as a decoration as well as a very necessary accessory. Some ladies even had a brass button of their husband's or sweetheart's military uniform made into hatpins by way of showing support for them. Out of this came the huge hatpin manufacturing industry. The steel shafts were made mainly in Sheffield, as they were already manufacturing sewing needles there. It was hard work cutting, pointing, grinding, hardening, straightening, stamping, gilding and plating the stem or shaft of the hatpin. When the shafts were finished, it was left to the women to complete the final stages. One of the most skillful tasks allocated to women was glass blowing. The flame from a gas jet was used to heat a glass rod, which the women rotated swiftly to make from the molten tip a round or pear-shaped glass head on top of the shaft. Other types of pinheads were made of porcelain, gold, mother of pearl, enamel, ivory, moonstone, jet and garnets. Finally, the finished hatpins were pushed into cards for display, whilst more expensive types were put into specially made boxes. Such hatpins were designed by René Lalique or Fabergé, and some of the glass pinheads were made in Bohemia. The hatpin has become a collector's item now, and diamond Fabergé hatpins sell for many thousands of euro at auctions. I don't own a hat, but I wish that my grandmother's hatpins hadn't disappeared with her. Sometimes when I look in the mirror of my hall stand, I almost hear her whisper, "A girl's best friend is her hatpin."
Our romance won't end on a sorrowful note, though by tomorrow you're gone. The song is ended, but as the songwriter wrote, the melody lingers on. They may take you from me.
Thirteen years ago, I won tickets to see Ireland play the All Blacks. It was the first rugby match I'd ever been at, and it was an autumn international in Croke Park. Now, I'm a lifelong GAA fan, and I'd been in Croker hundreds of times since I was 6 or 7 years old, but it was strange to see the old place filled with people with nice overcoats and brown brogues, and quite an experience being there for a match where nearly everybody was cheering for the one team. But I felt like an observer, and I realised that part of the enjoyment of being at a sporting event, for me anyway, involves shouting at the ref and getting head up. And when you don't know the rules of rugby, you can't really get properly upset at refereeing decisions. A few summers before that, we went on holidays to a campsite way over in the east of France, near the Swiss border, a place called Rougemont, full of fresh air and green hills and a big river. The kids were at that age where you had to encourage them to go off and make new friends so that you could sit down for an hour in the morning and just have a quiet coffee on your Deccan. Day two of the holidays, and I clocked this old Toyota Land Cruiser with an Irish flag in the back, pulling into the site. The driver was a well-built guy who was travelling with his family. He wore a Stetson hat and one of those big Australian waterproof coats. And we bumped into each other a few times over the course of that day. And by the next day, in the way that campsite holidays develop, Gary and I were friends. And over the week, and over a beer or two, we sat and we talked about everything, north, south, France, families, holidays, and sport. He loved sport. And he told me he'd represented Ireland at the hammer throw. We talked a bit about that. And he mentioned rugby. And I knew he'd played rugby by his ears. But it was the evening of day three or four before I actually asked him, "Did you play for, like, Leinster? Ireland?" And he said he did. And I was seriously impressed. He said, "I actually scored a try for Ireland." "Wow," I said. "Yeah, against the All Blacks." "What? In the World Cup? You are kidding me," I said. By this stage, I was blown away. And then I was thinking inside, I was thinking, "I know this. I know this. I know this. I know who you are. What's your surname?" And he said, "Halpin." "Oh my God, Gary Halpin. I remember the try. And you give them the fingers." And then they stuffed us. And that's what I mean. I don't know much about rugby, but like, I follow the news. We had one more night in the campsite, and we were heading back to the ferry. His family were heading on down, if I remember rightly, to the Czech Republic. And he dug out a guitar, I pulled out a low whistle, and as all our kids were running around, the four of us sat and supped beers and sang songs and had the best of crack. And then he asked me, "Where are you guys going to?" And I said, "We're heading over towards Cherbourg. Ferry home on Friday morning." "And where are you staying?" "Don't know," I said. "We'll probably just see where we end up. Maybe get a wee cheap auberge somewhere." "Sure, stay in our place," he said. What do you mean? Turned out he had a house near a little village called Sainte-Mère-Église. Stay there, he said, and you can have a look round the Normandy beaches and all. I was stunned. And while I'm saying, no, 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 not at all, no, don't be ridiculous, no, 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 we're not doing that, no, 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 he lifted his mobile, rang a number and said, Patsy, there's people coming to stay for a few nights. We'll arrange where to pick up the key and then John, yeah, John, John, what's your surname again? And we went and we stayed and we did the Normandy beaches and we always said, what an extraordinary act of generosity to open your doors to a family you'd had a few beers with over three nights and take no money for it. I spoke to him a few times since, but occasionally when his try was replayed or he was on as a pundit talking about rugby, or even when it was his birthday in February, we kind of nod at each other and go, do you remember Gary? So when it was announced that he died at only 55 years of age, our family were all shocked, like genuinely shocked. Shocked for a man we haven't seen in more than 10 years. But that's kind of irrelevant. Gary Halpin trusted a family of complete strangers with the keys to his house. Now, as I say, I mightn't know much about rugby, but I do know a good person. And we'll always remember his generosity.
An Kittel. Scáhanna fada ag sína I dro bun na spéire, an tíde tráite, fuacht na híhe ag tjana ling. Balíon ma wáhar clocha, crohíon si kirkul, líonan si le kréfóga é, agus curan si an kittel in a híon uas ar sin. A hóin dúf dóite ag kohormú go kiotach án, go korahónach mar asal. Agus amach o chyrkul fochna na glocha lia agus na nion na lohna to siin lasraga ag rainka sa vioan. Tien mahar kon a hila bati a oil don tina. Tomid saite ag mairach dan vrohul go meran agla varav graimoring nach mero ag an tishka, go nimo ag an tina, go nelo ag an law agus gwil blas na grenya a shkyuba on ar graken. The kettle. Long shadows stretching away towards the horizon, the tide gone out, the chill of the night moving in. My mother gathers stones and makes a circle. She fills it with twigs and puts the kettle on this. It sits giddily like a donkey, its black arse wobbling. And out from that sheltered circle of grey stones and in spite of the breeze, the flames start to dance in the gust. My father goes to gather more sticks for the fire. We are tight together in the joy of the heat until a deathly fear takes a grip of us that the water won't boil, that the fire will go out, that the day will disappear and that the heat of the sun is disappearing from our skins.
On this morning's programme, we heard A Horse Whipping in Chicago by Conal Hamill, Mary Quite Contrary by Lourd Mackey, Humpty Dumpty by Michael O'Loughlin, The Power of Hat Pins by May Leonard, Random Acts of Kindness by John Toll, and An Kittel, The Kettle, a poem in Irish and English by Catherine Foley. This morning's music began with Daddy Wouldn't Buy Me a Bow Wow, sung by Vesta Victoria. Then we heard Schubert's Serenade, played by Julian Lloyd Webber on cello with John Lenehan on piano. After that, we heard Up Went Nelson by Go Lucky Four. Then They Can't Take That Away From Me, sung by Ella Fitzgerald. And finally, Le Vie en Rose, played by Daniel Hope on violin with Christopher Israel on piano. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey. The producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can find more from this and other RTE Arts and Culture programmes at rte.ie/culture.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.